Good morning, good afternoon, good evening here from the Vienna Stock Exchange. I welcome all viewers in Vienna, in Austria, and from around the world. I'm very much looking forward to the next hour, which will be a conversation about the future and risk. And as you know, the Vienna Stock Exchange is celebrating its first 250 years. And in the past, the stock exchange has been a pretty good indicator for the future. Even though there are some swings, overall, the stock market and the Vienna Exchange has been a pretty good indicator about the future. So we'll talk about that. The title of our event, of our conversation today, is Predicting the Future, Uncertainty Beyond Crisis. And this event is the first in a series that will follow later this year. So you should say stay tuned, and thank you very much to the Vienna Exchange for making this series possible. I'm sure it will be very interesting for the remainder of the year. There's one thing that you should know. It was a very smart and the right decision to join today, because we have two experts who are always right, and they know what they're talking about, and they're always predicting the future. So we not only will make you very smart in the next hour, but if you listen very carefully and do the right things, you'll also be rich by the end of the year. So please listen carefully. Good. Let me introduce my two guests today. Monika Rosen, she's the head of research at Bank Austria Premium Banking, and she's been in that role for more than 20 years, and she's a professional predictor of the future. And you know, I sometimes wonder, when I get out of the house in the morning, does my job have an impact? What's the difference? What kind of difference do I make? But I'm pretty sure that Monika knows what kind of difference she makes, because she's overseeing and helping to invest 33 billion euros. Yes, I repeat, 33 billion euros. So she knows what the impact is of her decisions. She can measure it every day, every week, probably even every second. So she's a professional forecaster. Monika, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you very much for the marvelous introduction. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for having me. Happy birthday to the Vienna Stock Exchange for 250 years anniversary. And the introduction has made me quite nervous. So I'm breaking out in a cold sweat already. But let's see what the next hour brings. If I am the predictor you make me out to be, I ought to know, shouldn't I?
Wonderful. Monika is joining us from Vienna, and I'm now turning to France, where I welcome Didier Sornet. He is the professor of entrepreneurial risk at ETH Zurich, and he's also chairing the Financial Crisis Observatory, which is an institution which tries to identify and monitor financial risks and financial bubbles. So if I dare say, you are the professor of the bubbles, and you are the expert on the bubbles. And Didier is well known around the world for monitoring these kind of bubbles, and we are going to talk a little bit about bubbles in the next hour as well. So welcome to you as well, Didier.
Good day to everyone. I'm very happy to be here. And actually, in terms of being, you know, interested in bubbles, the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times a few years ago had me under the title Didier Sornet, the Dragon Slayer. And it was really marvelous, you know, for my kids to have their father, you know, being like a knight fighting really important things.
So you're not only a professor but also a knight, which is
I wish I would,
which is good. So you have to show us the picture at some point, but it's good. So welcome to the two of you again, and just to give you an overview, so we'll have three parts for our conversation. And in the first part, we're going to try to predict the year 2021, which I call a little bit of a classic forecasting exercise. We're trying to see what markets are going to do over the next year, what kind of other risks are out there, be it health risks, climate risks, political risk. So we're going to do a little bit of a classic forecasting exercise of what the experts think will be important in the year 2021. Second part, we're going to talk about the science or the art of predicting the future. So how do you do it? What's the right approach if you want to make a forecast? And I think this is going to be very interesting because, as you know, one of the big buzzwords over the past couple of years has been artificial intelligence and collecting data and data intelligence, etc. So a lot of people think that all your artificial intelligence is making us actually smarter and giving us better predictions. I sometimes think that all the machines and all the algorithms that are out there are sometimes also at risk of producing artificial stupidity, if I may say. So that means that, you know, we are relying on the data, we are relying on the machines, but how much human quality control, how much human brain do we need to combine these two elements so that our forecasts and our predictions actually get better? So that will be the second part. Predicting the future, is it a science or is it an art? And then lastly, the third part is an interesting element that I have been wondering for the past 44 years about, and I'm very happy that you will be able to give us the answer. And it's a little bit, you know, what does it mean in your personal life if you think about risk all the time? Because our human brain, in one way or the other, is programmed to identify risks all the time, all day long. Is there a lion coming? Is there not a lion coming? Can I do this? Can I do that? And all the topics about thinking fast and slow, Daniel Kahneman, we all know the discussions. And I wanted to ask the two risk experts, what does it do to your personal lives, to your private lives? You know, how should we deal with risk when we leave the house in the morning? So that was the introduction. Now let's get into the first topic, the outlook, the classic forecast for this year. And stock markets, bond markets have been a little bit volatile over the past couple of days. But overall, Didier, when you look at the markets around the world, and under the assumption that the stock market is actually reflecting perfect crowd intelligence, you would have to think that the future overall is very, very bright. Nothing can stop us from here because we are fairly close or at historic highs, and everything looks peachy and shiny. So would you say this is the right approach? What do you think it's going to happen this year?
So yes, the future is very bright for the top 0.1% and for broadly diversified investors, clearly, who will not react too much to the volatility, short-term volatility of the market. But when you look at, let's say, the trajectory of the financial markets, US, Europe, from the bottom March 2000, the COVID crash, as it's called, up to now, you see essentially a perfect, almost perfect correlation between the stock market behavior and the amount of liquidity injected by central banks. Right, the two curves are essentially fluctuating parallel, right? And the liquidity injection, I think, if my number is correct, is about 15, 16 trillion rushed in a year or a bit less than a year, right, globally. And the future is not very bright for a vast majority of the population. And even for investors who are subjected to the risk, the policy risk, the central banking risk. So essentially the market are no more driven by, you know, this standard view, which should be the view that they anticipate the future performance of the economy, they have become the anticipators of the policymakers. So maybe Monica, I can develop on this, but I think I propose answer should be short in order to have a better conversation. Yeah.
So Monica, if I understand you correctly, if I may jump right in, Didier, you're saying that the markets are liquidity driven. I agree 100%, of course. Very accommodative monetary policy has helped here tremendously. I would summarize it from a market viewpoint, and I'm going to stick to my knitting here, as we'll have a great economy, because yes, I do think we will overcome the crisis, and I do think the economy will come roaring back, and we'll have an okay market. I'm quoting as somebody here, I don't remember who said that, but I think that is an excellent summary and a little bit what's playing out at the moment, even that this rise in yields is unsettling markets here a little bit. So indeed, if the prognosis, the forecast on the economic front comes to fruition, that might disturb markets a little bit, because then we will get to the point where we've overcome this. We are no longer looking forward to the post-pandemic world, but we are in the post-pandemic world, and that's what I'm worried about a little bit in terms of the markets. What are we going to do for an encore?
So, Monica, if you allow me, Matthias, to react, I will play a bit a different tune. I'm a bit less optimistic with respect to the medium-term outlook of the economy. And my, let's say, diagnostic is based on the roots even before, you know, the recent years or the recent months, going back to the crisis of 2008, which
so that everybody understands you, the OATs, the French government bonds. Is that what you're talking about?
No. I'm saying, sorry. So can you hear me correctly? I'm just saying that I would like to go back to the roots, very much further.
The roots, okay, I'm sorry, roots. I didn't understand that.
Roots. Going back to 2008, you know, the crisis of 2008, and even going back 30 years earlier to the roots of the crisis of 2008. So if I can paint the picture very quickly, you go out of the Second World War, you have the 30 Glorieux, the 30 years of extraordinary economic boom, great productivity growth and so on, which is not only reconstruction, kind of Keynesian reconstruction, but also a lot of productivity gains associated with the unique in the world research effort during the World War, the Second World War, right? Which goes to the private sector, which improve technology, physics, electronics, and also management. Management is much better for the next decades and so on. And then it slows down and the growth is replaced by, I'm of course being very schematic, but I think these are the main forces, is replaced by debts and finance. So we clearly see the transition around 1980, where the country's growth of Western economies has been fueled by debts and finance. And you can see that by a succession of bubble and crashes, but also the booming importance of debts and finance in many sectors. And for me, 2008 is the, let's say, correction or the exhaustion of this model of from 1980 to 2008 of an economy fueled by finance and debt and not really by strong productivity growth. For example, two-thirds of the productivity during the 30 years before the crisis 2008 was finance. I mean, this has been well established by the economists. And then you have the rebound from 2008, so I'm getting closer to the present, essentially fueled by, as Summer said, as a kind of summer joke, you know, we had too much debt, too much finance, too much excess, and so on. The solution to go out of this is more debts, more finance, and more excesses, right? And so we have this QE1, QE2, QE3, QE infinity, QE twist, and so on. And then we think that we are out of the woods, but actually the productivity has not come back. So the real fundamentals of a very sound economic growth is not there. And then we have COVID. Right. So Yes, of course, you're right, Monica, that the economy is going to rebound, but rebound. So, you know, when we lose 50% on the market, you need to grow by 100% to go back to even, right? So, of course, we are going to rebound. We are going to rebound because we have plunged and we have essentially imprisoned whole hundreds of millions of the population who are not producing with lockdown, with confinement, with all these things. So, of course, we are going to rebound. But to say that we are going to have an extraordinary economy, I think is, for me, forgetting the where we come from and the fundamental strengths of what is economics growth.
The one question I have for the two of you is, so over the past couple of years, we had all these helicopters more or less flying around the world and just throwing money at pretty much everyone and everything that is moving. And that obviously was one of the reasons why markets are up. So, and so far, inflation hasn't really been a topic. And now, even though I would say, you know, academic theory would probably say sooner or later inflation has to come. And now, over the past couple of days, it looks a little bit like, you know, inflation is not that, and maybe it's coming back. So I wanted to ask you two things. One, what about inflation? You know, is it coming? And second, how are central banks going to get out of the whole helicopter money thing? How is it going to happen technically? Because it's trillions and trillions and trillions of euros. The moment the first central bank is signaling to stop the liquidity, what's going to happen and how do you do it without disturbing markets?
Monica, you want to go first, ladies first?
Yeah, why don't I? Well, I mean, the taper tantrum in 2013 proved that markets can indeed become quite shaky if central banks act too swiftly. But I do think that central banks globally, or at least in the Western world, have learned their lesson on that score. Of course, the inflation debate is a tricky one. We're going to have a base effect in terms of the oil price print has tripled year over year. But I think that will sort of oscillate out as we progress further into 2021. And so, yes, there will be certain inflationary pressures, but we view them as being temporary. In terms of central bank reaction, that is going to be tricky. Granted, I would agree there. But I think they have learned a lesson. They know to be careful. They will reduce bond purchases. They will be very slow, I think, and do this very gradually. They are very mindful of financial markets, for better or worse, as Didier has just outlined. So I would expect a certain degree of nervousness, certainly, as I've said earlier, we'll have a good economy or even a great one, perhaps, and an okay market. Because looking out, things, as I said, the perfect honeymoon scenario might come to an end sooner or later. But I don't think we're looking at another crash. I don't.
So on inflation, it's very interesting to ponder why, with the extraordinary money printing, you know, liquidity injection that skyrocketed from 2009, March 2009, and that was a QE1, have we not seen so much inflation or even negative inflation in many places, which is actually, you know, in academic circles, in professional circles, a paradox, a conundrum, right? But this is not, if you understand that. Inflation is not everywhere a monetary phenomenon, as famously said by a famous economist. But it is essentially strongly correlated with buying power of the majority. So what you can explain very easily why there has not been inflation, at least not inflation in the CPI as it is measured. There has been a lot of inflation, actually, a lot of inflation in real estate, a lot of real estate when you have to pay twice the price you used to pay for buying an apartment. You know, if you don't call it inflation, so there are many sectors, many assets that has been inflating immensely. For example, the price of an apartment in Zurich has essentially doubled from 2007, 2015. Okay, so a lot of inflation in certain sectors, but no inflation in the CPI simply because the wages of people have been stagnant or even decreasing. And it's, of course, the effect of globalization, the competition with China and Vietnam and so on and so forth. So as long as people don't have buying power, there's no inflation simply because of supply demand. So it's not, so the question is when you print money, is where is the money going? If it's only parked on the balance sheet of banks and so on, and companies to make up for the, you know, the toxic holding and so on, there's no inflation because people don't buy. So now the question actually about inflation is more severe. Why? Because there is a glut of, from the producers, in particular Brazil, for various reasons, you know, they have been a severe core of the pandemics. They are the biggest commodity providers. Their ports are not fully functioning and so on, and the harbor. And so this is explaining, for example, a significant increase in commodity price. And of course, commodity price is going to spill over to you know, higher price for the consumers and therefore potentially to inflation. So it's a significant worry also that, you know, with fiscal policies to give more purchasing power to people that they need, mechanically inflation will derive from this increasing purchasing power, which was not existent due to the globalization forces, which are disappearing now simply because of the separation, you know, of the Chinese, or East China as a, the great, you know, industry builder and factory of the world, and the recentering of production in the West. So many of the factors that prevented inflation to occur are now present. In terms of the central bank tempering, I'm much like Monica, but a bit less optimistic, in the sense that if you go back to my story before, that we are in a trap since 1980s with no growth, no productivity gain, and no real sufficient investment for creativity, for invention, for discoveries, for innovations, we need more and more depth. You know, the power of depth in generating GDP has disappeared. As it's a very well-known academic fact and empirical fact that the effect of depth is needed. So I think we are in a new normal where depth of 120% GDP is a new normal, no more than 60% of the Maastricht Treaty. And it will be extremely difficult to go back to normal. Extremely difficult. Except a war. Except a big war.
Oh, heaven help us! Let's not anticipate that, for crying out loud. But I was going to ask: did I understand you correctly that you think that globalization is on the retreat, because now we've learned our lesson from the pandemic, and we will produce there will be more inclination to produce locally, and we will sort of bring everybody back into the home base. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, yes. The main force are going to increase the wages of the people in the West, simply because there's less, of course, there's still less opportunity for arbitraging by using lower cost wage earners in China, for example, right? So it's not a perfect thing, but it is a tendency in this direction that was a
main. I'm not sure I agree. I mean, okay, right now it looks like tendencies are going in that direction. And of course, we are all now COVID obsessed, and how could we not be? But as time moves on and we move out of this crisis, and it will be a distant memory, all the crises in the past have been overcome and retreat into the past. I think that the globalization will come back in its previous form. I highly doubt that we will sort of return production facilities totally into our own countries. That seems a little bit far off. That would, in my opinion, only come to fruition if this pandemic were to become a permanent phenomenon. And I certainly hope that that, and I don't believe it will be, and I hope that won't be the case.
Let me jump in right here, because we promised our viewers to get smart, rich, and possibly happy. So if you inherit, say, I don't know, 10,000 euros or 100,000 euros today, Monica, what would you do with it? DJ, what would you do with it? Stocks, bonds, Tesla, a bottle of wine, you know, a painting, a new dress. What's the best? What should you do with 10,000 euros tomorrow?
With 10,000 euros? Okay, well, okay, I don't know enough about wine, and my dresses don't cost that much, so those things are out. No, what will you have me say? I work in a bank. We have an asset allocation. We have an investment strategy, and I would stick with that. But I also, from personal experience, since you've asked that before, I would invest in a diversified portfolio, because come rain or come shine, and through all the crises in the past, a little bit of everything in a basket, bonds and stocks, depending on my personal tolerance for risk, has sort of carried the day each and every time. So a diversified portfolio, it sounds boring, it sounds like an old cliche, but I've been around long enough to say that has sort of carried the day, if you will, each and every time, and that's what I would do with it. Especially under the circumstances right now, I can't say I would travel, because that's what I'd really like to do, but I can't.
Didier, what would you do?
Yeah, it depends, of course, on your time horizon. If you have 1 year to live, of course, you'll enjoy and have wine and things like that. But I would say, indeed, I always give the advice that, notwithstanding the fact that the equity market is quite expensive, you should be invested in equity, obviously. This is the tide that is pushing all the boats up. Not in all equities, so that you know, depending on your sophistication and availability of advice and so on, you have to be, not all equities are the same. Of course, tech is quite expensive, I've received it and so on. There has been a big bubble, but a lot of expectation on them. You should be exposed to them. You should be exposed to, if you want to be really the long-term shot, exposed to China bonds. I think this is a really strong, there is a very strong argument. China is playing now the role of the Buddha's bank, right? It's the only central bank in China is the one who has a significant interest rate and really is pricing the growth, the future of the, you know, a large interest rate does not just mean that it is costly for debts, right? To have debts, it's also a predictor of what is the economic growth in the future, right? It is actually a signal also. It can be used in different ways. So being exposed to China would be very good. And I would be also exposed to crypto to play. And of course, I would 5% idea that can lose it, right? And there's big risk with crypto. You want to be exposed to crypto. Bitcoin in particular.
Yeah. Thank you for the first part. I think we'll move on to the second part, so we know what to do now with our money. And the second part, I'll let me call it crystal clear crystal balls versus cloudy crystal balls. So what do you need to do so that you can have a crystal clear crystal ball? And Didier, I wanted to ask you, you know, while all the risks that led to various crises in the past 25 years were known in abstract and in theory and in academic literature, very few people actually predicted them correctly. Possibly nobody predicted them correctly. So I wanted to ask you, we're all talking about COVID now, COVID, 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 inflation. What other risks are out there that nobody's talking about right now, but that you should have, you know, on your screen?
So I'm sure there are always somebody speaking about some risk because there are so many. Okay, so what I would put as less discussed, for example, I'm very concerned, I'm very interested by this cryptocurrency, Bitcoin and so on. We have shown, you know, we have passed the $1 trillion capitalization Bitcoin, for example, right, recently. And Ethereum and many others, and many banks, many institutions are supporting this. So what about a 51% attack on Bitcoin and the total collapse of the cryptos? So I'm concerned about that because there's a lot of potential bugs remaining in the system, in the underlying technology. And also the there's extraordinary inequality and imbalance in the computer powers of the miners, of the people who actually, you know, make the system work. So actually, it's not impossible to imagine that the system, the whole parallel gold structure, you know, the storage of money that is endorsed by many in order to, for example, diversify against the liquidity injection by central banks, might have intrinsic vulnerabilities. Another risk that is worrying me a lot, which is not discussed, I think, a lot, is we are obsessed with COVID, but and we are obsessed with, let's say, climate change and so on. But are we obsessed with chronic disease, endocrine perturbators, collapse of fertility, pollution, water sustainability? So for me, I mean, much more than, you know, the obsession that we have too much CO2. CO2 is a molecule of life with oxygen. We are totally polluted by hundreds of thousands of chemicals, which are totally making us, you know, allergia did not exist 50 years ago. Less than 100% American. Now it's 80%. So we are ill globally as a civilization. We are carrying a lot of pollutants in our body everywhere. You need to eat three or four apples to have the same level of vitamin that you used to in 30 years ago and so on and so forth. So my fear as a risk is that this slowly, you know, moving deterioration give rise to a transition to nonlinearity and a cascade. Because this is what we know, is that things move progressively, like a probable frog in the heating pan, and then suddenly you have a bifurcation to something that you can you cannot react, and people are surprised. Last, very quickly, I'm worried about the China-US open conflict, because we have a growing empire and we have an existing empire. And if history is any guide, this has almost never ended well. And the US is the most, let's say, warlike nation. It has never been out of a war there since its inception. And China is not going to let go its vision of becoming a great power. So I fear, as a citizen of the world, that we are here coming to a quite unstable situation potentially.
Monica, what keeps you up at night? What are we overlooking here?
Well, I don't know about keeping me up at night, but listening to DDA for any length of time would certainly keep me up at night. It makes me depressed. You see, you're rattling off the problems of the world in a way that is not good for my mental health. Okay, so in terms of the markets, what can I say? Some of the things that we've mentioned in the past have the potential to unsettle markets, in my opinion. Inflation or fear of inflation might be one of them. Certainly, we don't expect it. I hope it won't happen, but it is theoretically conceivable that one central bank might get the transition towards a stricter monetary policy, might get that wrong a little bit, or might screw that up, if you pardon my saying so. So those are some of the things that could rattle markets. But I would like to add a more general term. Again, drawing on a number of years from experience, as you've mentioned in your introduction, Matthias, the market might be cognizant of certain facts, but the timing and the extent and the exact moment when it will come to bear is almost never predicted correctly. I am of the opinion that that is not doable. And I would like to add one major proof, in my opinion, for that. If you could predict that correctly, the Morgan Stanleys and the Goldman Sachs of this world, they have all the money in the world, they have all the machines, all the human intelligence and the artificial one to boot, probably, to predict it and to work it out, and they can't. Mm-hmm. So in my opinion, it is not doable. Even if we, the housing crisis was a perfect example. Yeah, Greenspan was worried about that, but when exactly it was going to hit, nobody saw that coming. Yeah, so that part I think is very hard to do. So all you can do is try to protect the portfolio, try to have a balanced approach, try to be ready for a number of curveballs when they're being thrown your way. But you will, I think, in this business, have to live with a certain level of uncertainty.
Monica, let me just follow up here. So it's all about getting it right. So I wanted to ask you, in your career, be it professional in the bank or private, you know, what was the most accurate prediction that you've ever made? How did you get it right? You know, why did you get it right? Did you spend weeks or month or just a second? And what was the impact? Did you get rich? Did you meet your partner? Did you, you know, go to the right vacation? What would you say?
I would say, I've been thinking about that, if I may confess that, I would say accepting the position of head of research. And I am saying this, we have International Women's Day on Monday. I am particularly talking to all the ladies who are listening out there. I confess here on this live stream, I had the typical female reaction when my boss at the time asked me if I wanted to be head of research. I said no. And in terms of timing, it took me a weekend. I talked to my partner at the time who encouraged me and gave me a lot of support, for which I'm very grateful. And on Monday, I came back to the office. Back then, we were not in home office. And I said, I've changed my mind and I do want to be head of research and I've never looked back. It's changed my life. So yes, it takes courage to go out of your comfort zone. Yes, you may be hesitant. Yes, we are not men. We do not suffer from overconfidence. We are sometimes way too critical of ourselves and we need to overcome that. It is difficult. I know I made the mistake. I corrected it. And look at me now. If I hadn't said yes then, I wouldn't be on this live stream. I would not have met Didier, and that would have been a shame.
What was your worst prediction?
My worst prediction. Okay, I've thought about that as well. So that I'll give you another personal example. Everybody talked me into it, so I took my driver's license. I passed at the first attempt. I knew I was never going to master the art of driving. I am not good at motor skills. I was afraid from the start. I was sweaty during those lessons. I passed at first attempt. I've never driven since. It's been sunken costs, and I should have known, but I let everybody talk me into it.
Didier, what did you get right? What did you get wrong in your life?
So I'm very happy because I can catch two birds with one net here. And answer to Monica when we said, I have a proof that it's impossible to predict, take the real estate market. So in 2005, I wrote a letter to Alan Greenspan, sharing with him, I was a professor at UCLA at the time, as well as a director of research in France. But I remember I wrote from UCLA and I told him that our analysis have diagnosed that the real estate market is in an unsustainable trajectory. And I was proposing to him that to share our technology, our methodology in order to manage better the policy of the Federal Reserve. In June 2005, we published on the International Archive a prediction which said that we estimate that the peak of the stock market in the US would be in the summer of 2006. Of course, the precision is plus or minus a quarter, and you may remember the history of the real estate market. The peak was in the summer of 2006. So I have a fundamental disagreement, of course, with Monica on this aspect. I don't claim at all. So we have in our Financial Crisis Observatory repeated this feast many times for many cases. The last one, which is of global significance is, for example, the prediction of the peak of the Chinese market in June 2015. Greenspan, you don't ask me, did not reply, right? So it's a pity, but I don't pretend to have predicted the financial crisis itself, right? The Great Recession and so on, because it's a very big difference. What we saw is that the financial market and the recent market were on unsustainable path, and that the correction, but what type of correction is very difficult. It's like, crossing the boundary, the horizon of black hole. Beyond that, policymakers come in, central banks, inject liquidity and so on. So the rule of the game changed. Even the Congress might act and change the rule of the game. So I don't pretend that we can predict what's going on, but we can predict this. We have pockets of predictability when systems go out of whack, when there is this positive feedback, procyclicality that are unfolding. So this is actually not my best prediction, but I wanted to mention it because, it's like a counterpart to what Modica is claiming. My best prediction, I think, was a silver in 2011 and also Swiss franc against euro in 2011. We were able to predict the peak at 1 minute time scale using our technology, which never happens usually. And we made a lot of money, of course. Mm-hmm. So there are sometimes a kind of, in my language of as a scientist, a collapse of dimensionality of the complexity that makes the market almost perfectly predictable, but it's very, very rare and very short times. And the risks, of course, are very large. Huh?
Yes, and so this is bringing me to my final question for the second part. So there is the machines are out there, the algorithms are out there, all the data is out there. Everybody's talking about data all the time. And sometimes that leads to a no decision because we don't know. And, we need more data. Monica, how would you approach that? And when do you say enough data is enough data? And here's my gut feeling. And, combined with the data, this is what we're going to do. When is the right moment to make that decision?
No hard and fast answer, in my opinion. Contrary, may I say, contrary to what you've said in your introduction, I never make these decisions alone. I am in a committee, for better or worse, and we are a group, and we take the decision together, collectively. And so you have different opinions coming to bear, but I think, As I've mentioned before, occasionally I have a feeling that we tend to overemphasize data. Not to say that science is not, of course, important and should be, and I'm not saying that, but there is a certain element of art to the science, at least in terms of equity of market asset allocation and market analysis. And I think you should respect that and should kind of go with the flow, perhaps even go with your experience that comes from several years or decades even of looking at market action. That's the way I would answer that. I can't give you a better answer than this, really.
Thank you. Didier?
So, there is this telling that we used to have wisdom, we downgraded to knowledge. We had knowledge, we downgraded to information. Without information, we downgrade it to data. Now, most data is noise. I mean, we are overwhelmed with noise, right? More important than data is the quality of the data. I can tell you that, as a financial operator, professional, and so on, we spend much more time cleaning data and ensuring that it is of good quality. You can buy, from the best provider the data you want, like it will be not of good quality. And you have to invest enormous amount of efforts, etc., to have good quality data. So data is not the panacea. There is no free lunch. You have to know your data to clean it and so on. And also, don't be the forest for the tree. The problem with data is that this is always, I have this experience in so many examples, from prediction earthquakes to all fields I've been in, and I've been working in medicine and so on. Everybody says, yeah, data will solve the problem. It does not solve anything because it's noise. If it's not structured by model and theory and guideline, it doesn't solve even anything. So you have to be guided by hypothesis to use the data, which is very clean, very understandable and understood with this limitation. And then you can actually run the model with the data and get some prediction and then test again and again. Now, machine learning and AI assume that you don't need the model, but they are only good when you have enormous data which have little noise. And so it doesn't apply to finance.
Thank you. So I want to come to the last part because we only have 15 minutes left now. But, you know, I'm wondering, you're two professionals having spent your entire life on predicting the future and assessing risk all the time. So I'm wondering, when you leave your house or your apartment in the morning, do you think risk, risk, risk all the time because it's your professional identity? Or are you able to say, forget about the risk, I'm just doing things in the kind of normal, regular way without thinking about risk all the time? So what do you do when you leave your house in the morning, Monica?
I hope I am a very normal person. I do not think risk, risk, risk all the time. So I hope my job has not clouded my everyday behavior to that point yet. So I can answer this very briefly. I leave the house in the morning as everybody else does. Quite sound of mind, I certainly hope.
So no bricks coming from the rooftop?
If they should come, then that will be my fate.
Didier, do you see the bricks falling from the rooftop in the morning when you leave the house?
Okay, let me share the following. First, I'm much more obsessed with the upside risk, with the opportunity. So I'm not thinking of the brick or any negative risk. You may think I'm very pessimistic, Monica, with all the things that I said.
I get that feeling listening to you. I get an impression.
I try to watch things and then to see the opportunity. So I'm constantly obsessed with what we call the upside risk. Where are the opportunities? What we could do to change the world, or modestly, you know, to improve things around us, to help my students and so on. So this is what is moving me. And I always, you know, when I teach my students, I teach risk, obviously, and so on, risk management, dynamic risk management. But I emphasize immediately the upside risk, that actually it's absolutely necessary to take risks, to explore. And this is what is missing in this society. Just very quick. However, when I leave my house, I jump on my motorcycle. I am an avid motorcycle rider. I had 5 motorcycles. From more than 200 horsepower to, you know, trail bikes and so on. And there I do think of risk all the time. And I actually use it in my talk to hedge fund managers and to my students. I tell them that, and actually some of my students have said, Professor, you have special risk. How can you drive a motorcycle? Right? It seems like a disconnection. And I tell them, no, because you implement dynamic risk management. So I am constantly watchful, predicting the behavior of the other car, predicting the behavior of the pedestrian, trying to predict the slippery nature of the road and so on. So here I put my full radar system and cognitive abilities to try to predict the risk. So this is the only occasion when I put this on.
So I liked your idea about the upside risk. I'm wondering, so there's upside risk, there's downside risk. And I sometimes think there are two ways of approaching life overall. So the one is take a risk, fail, fail again, fail better, and then succeed, or maybe not. And I would call this a little bit kind of the American approach. In Europe, sometimes it's like, be very safe at the beginning, then move just a little bit, be safe again, maybe move a little bit more. And at the end of the day, you may be better off, you may be much better off, or nothing much has changed. So what would you say, why is public debate and attitude in Europe so much about, you know, the downside risk, if you will? In other parts of the world, in particular in North America, it's much more about the upside risk or opportunity, as you just said.
In my opinion, it also has to do with the historical context, the way the USA was founded and was conceived from the beginning, and perhaps even from the colonial past. Yeah, that this was a country that kind of built itself up and pulled itself up by its own bootstrings. So I would like to, I don't know if that really was 100% your question, but if I may take it personally, I would like to think of myself as having enough of an American attitude, optimistic and forward-looking, but I will also admit that I am reticent and that I am a little bit wary. So I would say it depends on the circumstances, it depends on what we're talking about. You can't always use the same brush stroke in every situation. And I think in certain circumstances, you should be careful, certainly. But overall, the way I go through life, I hope that I have enough of the American in me to be. I would like to inject one saying that I heard during my last trip to America that I liked very much. Jump and the net will appear.
So Didier, why is European public debate more about risk and not so much about opportunity?
Let me sidewalk on this question by citing von Bismarck, the founder of Germany. He said something like this. So your quotation is approximate. The stupid person learned from his own mistake. The intelligent person learned from the mistake of others. Right. So I think that this is something that we should try to emulate. Europe, I'm sorry, Monica, a bit pessimistic about Europe again, because I consider that not a society that doesn't take risk is a dead society. Actually, I've been developing with my student different models and international collaborators on what I call the zero risk society. I think we have shifted for some decades in this tendency to have this illusion of control and to really try to eradicate all risks. And if we don't take risk, we are dead. So that I'm very, very fearful that, you know, Europe is a dead body potentially between China, which has great ambition, extremely dynamical. I can tell you many stories because I go there very often. And US, which for the reason you said, Monica, is also very dynamical. So we need to promote a culture where creators also are rewarded. So I think in economics, we know that everything is controlled by incentives. When I see rock stars, when I see Hollywood stars, when I see influencers rewarded so much, and when I see creative people who take risk, who try to explore, inventors and so on are not so much rewarded. So for me, there's a design structure to promote exploration and also economic safety nets in order to empower the vast majority of people who don't want to take risk simply because it's too economically risky. You know, you need to have a level of wealth in order to be able to jump and wait and hope for the net to appear. If you are starving, you are not going to jump and the net will not appear.
I have one question here. So, Monica, you already mentioned it, but we have International Women's Day next week. So, you know, there are studies out there that women and men are approaching risk, reward, safety differently. And you know, if I may simplify, men take more risk, but also fail more often and then possibly are better off at the end of the day. Women are a little bit more cautious, take calculated risks, and are probably better off at the end of the day, but maybe not so much. Would you, obviously this is simplified and generalized, but what would you say is the difference when women and men are considering risk and the future?
Well, I have a number of things are going through my mind at the on that one. First of all, the fact that we outlive men by an average of 6 to 9 years, we as women, is testament to the fact that we, at the end of the day, are the ones better off, I think. Yeah, it's a proven fact that women will inherit 70% of wealth over the next 40 years just by outliving men. Now, it is also true that women tend to be more cautious, tend to perhaps see things from a more holistic approach, not just from from a more risk-taking or advantageous approach. May I inject this, Didier? I found it very telling that you did not answer the question of what was your worst prediction. So that is typical male behavior, and ladies out there, learn from the guy.
No, I did not. I would like to do it. I will do it now. I will do it.
I am talking, Mr. Vice President. I am talking, said Kamala Harris. Okay, so. So learn from the guys, don't criticize them. We have a different approach. We have perhaps more of a need for a security blanket. That is quite all right, but we should try to get out there and do things. And final thought, and then Didier can contradict me all he wants to. It points to the fact that we need more inclusion, we need more women on the team to counterbalance the often predominant male approach. That I firmly believe.
Take it away.
Great. Yes, I'm glad you agree.
Yeah, I agree. I realized that something was missing. I said, there's something I should have said. I forgot about it. So thank you for reminding me.
Of course.
My worst prediction.
This is the way of talking you out of this. I know. You know. I can. Good technique.
Do you give me 30 seconds to tell my worst prediction?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So it was in 2002. I published a paper when the market, the stock market, has just crashed in the U.S. and it was going like this, down, down, down. And I predict my most successful paper ever. I think it was downloaded 100,000 times. I mean, the editor called me and so on. And the title of the paper was "How long and deeper will the stock market, the stock market, would go?" And we were predicting another 20% drop. And what happened is that at the end of
2002, that one didn't pass.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and in the beginning of 2003, the market jumped up and then Easter. So what is the lesson I learned? Never fight the Fed, because our prediction was actually correct in foreign currencies. If you look at our prediction in British pound and euro, very good. But in dollar, very wrong. So now on women. You probably don't know, but he's a famous professor of anthropology. Professor Baumeister, he wrote a book that I'm sure you will enjoy immensely, Monica, and I propose that it should be mandatory reading for your Women's Day. The title is There Anything Good About Men? And actually,
it was written by a man.
Yes, written by Professor Baumeister.
Yes, there is.
Yeah, eminent anthropologist, professor of anthropology in the U.S. And essentially, he said that indeed men have not very good qualities and are useless. We need, if I may say so, one man per 1,000 women, you know, in terms of reproduction, roughly. And anyway, in terms of qualities, we should elaborate those of women. And actually, this book gave me an idea. I got in contact with him, and we developed a very in-depth study together, which was published, and now we consider to be the reference, which shows where it comes from, that men are so risk-taking and women are not risk-taking. And of course, this goes to the root and biological risks, that for a man, a risk of reproduction for an American, 3 minutes of pleasure, and for a woman is 10 or 15 years of commitment. If I just summarize in this way, and you can put this in agent-based model in theory and essentially derive that as a consequence, the risk-taking attitude and so on of men is totally different for women. For women, if I finish, a woman would like to always reproduce, excuse me, to be blunt as a biological scientist, with the alpha male, the top, because they have an investment of 10 to 15 years, right? So they all look at the top man to get the best genes. The problem of the man is that, you know, you have this distribution of abilities and fitness, and only a few are excellent and are the targets of the woman, right? What about the rest? What about all of us? So what we have to do is to fake, to signal what you are great. And how do we signal we are great? By taking huge risks. And that's the theory of Baumeister and the Develop Together.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We are actually coming to an end. I just want to throw out a question that just came in. We can't really answer it, but it's a good ending point, I would say, that we can all think about. You know, we had the dot-com crisis 20 years ago. We had the financial housing crisis 10 years ago. Now we have the COVID crisis. So let's reconvene in 10 years from now and see how many crises there were in between, or whether there is a certain pattern. And also, I would like you, Monica and Didier, to invite you for that we reconvene in 1 year from now, and that all our guests and all our viewers will tell us how much money they made, how much happier or not happier they are from all our life advice and financial advice and all the things. So I wanted to say thank you, Monica. Thank you, Didier, for taking the time, you know, sharing your thoughts, your expertise, your wisdom. I had great fun. Thank you also to the Vienna Stock Exchange for making this possible. And thank you to all our viewers and listeners. So there will be more conversations like this throughout the year. And we are very much looking forward to welcoming you to these events. Thank you, Monica. Thank you, Didier. Thank you, everybody on the screens. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My pleasure.